The National Book Awards were announced Wednesday evening at a ceremony in Manhattan. The Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters was given to the science fiction writer Ray Bradbury. His books include Fahrenheit 451, Something Wicked This Way Comes, The Martian Chronicles, and The Illustrated Man. About his writing, Bradbury has said he likes to deal with human problems, such as, what would it be like to be an average woman on the night before she goes off to Mars to join her husband? I spoke with him in 1988, after the publication of The Toynbee Convector, a collection of short stories. The first story gave a new twist to one of the oldest ideas in science fiction, the time machine. Bradbury explained what motivated him to write the story.
The problem of the world is doomsayers. We're surrounded by negative people. I can't stand them. I found out about them when I was 9 years old. Everyone made fun of me in the fourth or fifth grade because I collected the Buck Rogers comic strips. That was 1929. The future was never going to arrive. And I've been surrounded by people who never believed in the future. And it was true then, it's true today. So I, in that particular year, I tore up my comic strips, and a month later, I burst into tears and said to myself, why am I weeping? Who died? And the answer was me. I'd allowed these fools to kill me and to kill the future. So from that time on, I decided I'd never listen to another damn fool again in my life. And I went back and collected the Buck Rogers comic strips and insured my future and began to write about it, became a writer. So I've learned that by doing things, things get done. I'm not an optimist. I'm an optimal behaviorist. So that particular story in my new book, The Toynbee Convector, is based on my conviction that we insure the future by doing it.
I want to ask you about another short story in your new collection, The Toynbee Convector. The story is called The Thing at the Top of the Stairs, mm-hmm. and it's about an adult who's very afraid of the dark, as he was as a child, and he's afraid of walking up a staircase, an unlit staircase. There's a bulb that he has to turn on at the top of the staircase, mm-hmm. and he's afraid that waiting at the top of the staircase is a monstrous thing. Were you afraid of the dark when you were young?
Yeah, that's a true story. When I was 4, 5, 6 years old, we had the bathroom upstairs. And in the middle of the night when I had to go up there, I had to run halfway up the stairs, turn on the light before I could go the rest of the way. Well, when I was doing this, I'd always say to myself, now don't look at the top of the stairs because it will be waiting for you. And I never learned not to look because as soon as I looked up, there it was. And it was horrible. And I would scream and fall back down the stairs, and my mother or father would get up and sigh and say, oh, my God, here we go again. And they'd turn the light on for me and let me go upstairs. And so this is a vivid memory in my mind, and I write it so that other people, I suppose, reading it, will remember their own thing at the top of the stairs.
What shape did that it have in your mind?
That's a very hard thing to describe. I suppose it had a different shape every single night, maybe as the result of my seeing certain horror films that I dearly loved. You know, we all love horror films. And I saw The Hunchback of Notre Dame when I was 3, The Phantom of the Opera when I was 6. I think The Phantom stayed with me the longest. And it was probably The Phantom up there, with the moment when Patsy Ruth Miller tears off the mask of Lon Chaney and his face is revealed in all its gruesome detail.
I'm glad you mentioned The Hunchback of Notre Dame, too, because it's a movie I used to watch over and over and over again when I was growing up. The first time I saw it, it just terrified me. But I had to keep watching it again and again. I loved it so much. Did that movie scare you?
I don't know if it scared me. It touched me. Even mm-hmm. when you're 3 years old,
yeah.
the Lon Chaney version was very sympathetic and sad and very moving. And then the Charles Laughton version was the same way. I think all of us, no matter how we look, born into this world, feel something like the hunchback.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter if you have a beautiful face or not. I've talked to a lot of beautiful people in later years and found out that they went through the same thing in high school that I did. I went around with my face down most of the time because I was suffering from the usual outbreaks on the face that most kids of that age have. But then in later years, I met some beautiful women and beautiful men, and they all confessed to the same feeling, regardless of how they looked. I think the Casamoto appeals to all of us.
It was the Charles Laughton version that that I've seen the most times. Now, I know you worked with Charles Laughton, including working with him on an unproduced version of Fahrenheit 451. Did you ever talk with him about how potent The Hunchback of Notre Dame was for you?
Yes, I did. And we had a wonderful friendship. For a whole year there, about 30 years ago, I worked on a science fiction operetta for Charles and Elsa Lanchester, his wife. So that meant I was over at the house at least one day a week for almost a year. And he put on performances of the various Shakespearean plays for me, or scenes from the plays, scenes from Othello or Hamlet, or he did Lear at in England 1 year, and I was privy to his ideas on how to do Lear, or when he directed Major Barbara or The Apple Cart by Shaw. And the one thing that Charles Laughton gave to me that I've kept as a gift for all the years and has changed my life is him saying to me, use language for God's sake, because there's no language in the American theater anymore. We have no playwrights who use language, who care about saying something so beautiful and so correct. It has to be correct, it has to be true, but it can be beautiful, that it moves the heart and changes the lives of the people who see it. So when I went into full-time theater work, where I actually started when I was 12, but came back into it when I was 30, I dared to write language plays, and I'm still writing them. You can listen to what I have to say, and it sounds good, as well as being true.
I want to get back to the fear that you felt when you were in the dark climbing up the stairs as a mm-hmm. child. Is that kind of terror a good experience for us, for a writer, especially someone who spends part of their time writing science fiction?
Or fantasy or any other thing. Mm-hmm. Any experience that touches you in any particular way is good. It can be a horrible experience. I saw a car crash when I was 15 here in Los Angeles, and five people died as a result of it. I arrived at the scene of the accident within 20 seconds of hearing the collision. It was the worst mistake I ever made in my life. I didn't know what I was running into. People had been horribly mangled and decapitated. So for months after, I was shaken by it. It's probably the reason I never learned to drive. I was terrified at automobiles for a long time after that. But I turned it into a short story called The Crowd 6 or 7 years later, and that was part of my Ray Bradbury television theater 2 years ago. It was one of the things we produced. So out of this horror, this really terrible event, you take something that has taught you a certain kind of fear, I suppose, and you pass it on to others and say, this is what the car can do. This is an example of what the car can do.
You know, some writers have made a lot out of the fact that you don't drive. You know, the irony, one of America's premier science fiction writers, envisioners of the future, mm-hmm. doesn't drive a car. Has that ever seemed ironic to you, or do you just accept that there's reasons you don't want to drive?
No, it's no different than love poetry, is it? We don't write love poetry in the middle of an affair, do we? We write love poetry when we're away from our loved one, or we anticipate a loved one. It's lack that gives us inspiration. Huh? It's not fullness. Occasionally fullness can do that. But not ever having driven, I can write better about automobiles than the people who drive them. I have a distance here. Perhaps I have a secret yearning to own a Maserati someday and go to hell. I don't know. But space travel is another good example. I'm never going to go to Mars. But I've helped inspire, thank goodness, those people who have built the rockets and sent our photographic equipment off to Mars. So it's always a lack, though, that causes you to write that kind of story.
Have you had any direct correspondence with astronauts who've traveled through space?
Well, I've met most of them, thank goodness. Life magazine sent me down to Houston back in early 1967, and I met 60 of them. The Apollo missions were just beginning. So I got to meet almost everyone who finally wound up on the moon, and I bump into them on occasion over the years. It's a wonderful part of my life. I feel very fortunate that I not only started out with Buck Rogers in 1929, but wound up down at Houston, Cape Canaveral, in my own lifetime. I thought I would be a very old man by the time we landed on the moon. Well, I was only 49, and I feel privileged to be part of this greatest age in the history of the world.
Let's talk about some of your movies. Now, Fahrenheit 451 was made into a movie directed by Louis Malle. Your story.
No.
François Truffaut. I didn't mean that.
That's okay.
The Illustrated Man was made into a movie. Now, you actually wrote the screenplay for a book that had nothing to do with your books, Moby Dick.
That's right.
And you really, I have to say, seemed like a very unlikely choice to adapt Moby Dick for the screen. And I was wondering how you got to write the screenplay.
Well, by staying true to my own sense of the poetic. Again, here's where the influence of Shakespeare on my life, the influence of the Bible, which I was raised on. And by staying true to my love of poetry and my love of metaphor, which you learn from the Old Testament, the New Testament, and you learn it from Shakespeare, to speak in tongues, huh, that are so vivid that people remember the metaphor. And also by staying in love with dinosaurs. I fell in love with dinosaurs when I was 5. And I was walking along the shore with my wife one night down Venice, California, this 1949, and we found the ruins of the old Venice Pier, all the bones and the skeleton, the tracks and the ties of the roller coaster lying there in the sea. And I turned to my wife and I said, I wonder what that dinosaur is doing lying here on the shore. She was very careful not to answer, and 3 nights later, and I heard something in the middle of the night. I sat up in bed, looked at all the fog out beyond the window, and way out in the Santa Monica Bay, I heard the braying, the calling, the oconing of the foghorn over and over and over again. And I said, yes, that's it. The dinosaur heard the foghorn blowing, thought it was another dinosaur calling from a billion years of slumber, and swam for an encounter, discovered it was only a damned lighthouse and a damned foghorn, tore the whole thing down, and died of a broken heart on the beach. So next day I got out of bed and wrote The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, sent it to the Saturday Evening Post. It was published. John Huston read that one story, huh? And that changed my life forever because he thought he smelled the ghost of Melville in that story.
Oh,
what he smelled in it was the ghost of Shakespeare and the ghost of the Bible, huh? And so he called me on the phone and offered me the job. And a year later, when I was working on the screenplay one night, I said, John, how did I get this job? You know, everyone thought you were crazy. He said, well, I read that story about the dinosaur. And I said, well, I was very honest with you. I told you when I met you, I'd never read Melville. But once I got into Melville, I discovered he had been inspired by the same people who inspired me. So we were twins. He had been called upon by Shakespeare to cough up the white whale.
You've spent a lot of time imagining what the future might be like.
Mm-hmm.
What would you most like to be around to see about the future?
I'd like to come back every 50 years, and see how we can use certain technological advances to our advantage, say, in education. I think we're doing a dreadful job of educating now. We're spending $200 billion a year, $300 billion, whatever the figure is, a heck of a lot of money, and we're getting very small results because we're neglecting the first grade and the second grade. That's where the whole thing lies. And we have to revamp all of our ideas about the first and second grade, which means intensifying.
Wait a minute. You don't want to come back and find out if we've landed on Mars or not, and if there's life on Mars. You want to come back and see how the grade schools are doing.
It's not going to do any good to land on Mars if we're stupid.
Uh-huh.
And I want to save the future generation. I want to teach them to read when they're 5 and 6 and 7 years old. If we don't do that, we lose them forever. It's no use having remedial reading, which takes years of time, when you can do the whole thing in the first grade. We have to intensify our objectives there. It won't cost any money. It doesn't cost a darn thing. First grade is very cheap. It's the later grades where you got to spend money if you don't do it right.
Okay, well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Ray Bradbury recorded in 1988. This week at the National Book Awards ceremony, he was given the Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters. Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie, You Can Count on Me. This is Fresh Air.